But I think the buying by central banks is set to now start to increase. Central banks are completely insensitive to what the price of the gold is when they buy it, because after all, for the most part, they can print money at any time at ease if they want to and buy gold. They're not going to do that necessarily because that would devalue the currency and be a bit too visible. But we've seen that happening. We see it happening because countries around the world are issuing debt. And what are they doing with the debt?
Good morning, Clive Thompson. How are you?
Hello. Good morning, Andy. And I'm here in Switzerland. It's absolutely icy cold outside. The water is frozen everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. We actually just got pounded by the storm of a decade, if you would, or maybe storm of the last 5 years, snowstorm. So it's 32 degrees out. It is 6 in the morning. So it's all frozen out too. We have a bunch of snow. So I relate to you is what I'm trying to say. So now you have an interesting story, Clive, about how you got started into gold, gold investing. Can you, let's start with that. Tell us about that. And I have heard it before, but I want to hear it again from you.
Well, my story with gold goes way back before I made an investment as such. I must have been about 5 or 6 years old, and I was at my grandfather's house, and he had his friends round. And to play a bit of a trick on me, he put in front of me a bar of chocolate and a £1 note. And he asked me, Clive, which one would you like, the £1 note or the bar of chocolate? Well, of course, at 5 or 6 years old, I took the bar of chocolate. And he and all his friends burst out laughing because the chocolate bar, Cadbury's chocolate bar, was sixpence. Now, if you know anything about British money, those were the days where we had 240 pennies in the pound. So you could buy 40 bars of chocolate with a £1 note. So obviously that was highly amusing to all of them that I'd made the wrong choice. And a year later, I was back at my granddad's house and he tried to play the same trick on me. I mean, it must have been 6 or 7 by then. And he put the £1 note and the bar of chocolate and a gold sovereign on the table. This would be one of the very old sovereigns from early 1900s. And he said, Clive, what do you want? The bar of chocolate, the £1 note, or the gold sovereign? Just so for the viewers who don't know, a gold sovereign is a British £1 coin made of solid gold. Today it's worth £400 or something like that. Anyway, long and short of it is, I looked at these three and I thought, well, the coin doesn't look very interesting, but a pound note will buy me a lot of chocolate. So I took the pound note and he started laughing, but none of his friends laughed because they didn't know what a sovereign was. Don't forget, these were the days when, strictly speaking, you weren't allowed to own or buy or sell gold in the UK. There were plenty of these sovereigns still knocking around from the old days. So my grandfather, he actually worked for HMRC, that's the British Tax Authority. So he understood about investments, whereas most of his friends knew nothing about investments. So he tried to explain to his friends that this one's made of gold, and therefore, we'll talk about Gresham's Law, the bad money driving out the good money goes into your pocket and the bad money gets spent. And I don't think I understood that. I definitely didn't understand it. I'm pretty sure his friends didn't understand Gresham's Law at the time either. But that was the first exposure to a gold coin. But I kind of picked up that I made the wrong choice. I should have picked up the gold coin. Now, I suppose the £1 sovereign was worth maybe £3 at the time. I'm not sure if you could buy or sell them in the mid-60s. Well, it would have been about 65 or 63, something like 1963. Anyway, long and short of it was, when I reached the age of about 14 or so, I went to visit him in the hospital. And he showed me quite a few things, which are interesting things about investments. He had this little book of investments where he would write down the name of the stock every day and then the number of shares he'd got, and multiply it by the price and get a value. And then he'd add the column of values up and get the total value of the portfolio, like a spreadsheet of today. But in his exercise book, he had one page per day and he'd do it every day, reading the prices from the FT. But he also decided to give me his gold sovereign. while I was, when I visited him in the hospital. So I got this gold sovereign as a gift. And he said to me, Clive, keep this, never sell it, never give it away, and don't tell anyone you've got it. So I broke the last of those rules because I think, you know, he's been dead for 60 odd years, maybe 50 years. So I do tell people that he said, don't tell anybody. But I've still got that sovereign today. Anyway, I got to the age of 18 and I was working in the city of London. And I was curious about this sovereign because we had a, it was inside the firm I worked. I wasn't working for Sharpe's Pixley, but there was a firm called Sharpe's Pixley who were gold dealers. And it was actually inside the same building. So I went along to Sharpe's Pixley with my gold sovereign and I said, what's this worth? And I can't remember exactly what they said, but they gave me two prices. One, they'd buy it from me, and the other one, they'd sell me a second one. And I remember these two prices being really, really a long, long way apart. And I thought, you know, I'm not selling it at a low price. I'm not going to buy another one at a high price. It just didn't make sense. But it was probably something like they'd give me £15 for it and maybe wanted to sell me another at 20 or 25. I don't know. But it wasn't particularly attractive to trade at that price. But what did impress me a little bit was I had in my hand a £1 coin, which was worth a lot more than a pound. Let's call it £15 for simplicity. So I thought, that's interesting. This is a £1 coin. We didn't have the British £1 coin like we have today back then. This was the only £1 coin which existed, except it didn't circulate for obvious reasons. So being a smart 18-year-old, I decided to start walking around the banks with a pound note, trying to see if I could swap it in the banks for a gold sovereign. Well, of course, I had zero luck with that because they were all smarter than me and nobody was going to give me a gold sovereign for a pound note. Because my idea was to get some gold sovereigns and sell them to Sharpe's Pixley at 15 quid each. But that sort of arbitrage can't be done. But, you know, you learn a little bit as you go on. And I started to come to a realization that nobody's going to sell me a bit of gold, at least not at a pound. So maybe if people want it, I should want it too. And a few years later, I bought my first Krugerrand. I can't remember the price now, but it would have been probably £200, I'm guessing here. I don't know exactly, but not very much. And I believe I must have bought a Krugerrand every year for the next 30 or 40 years, at least one, sometimes more. So that was my first exposure to gold. But as the years went by, I came to realize one of the reasons why the gold price was going up was that the money was going down. And that's all to do with the amount of money. And I was living in Britain for a while and then overseas on the US dollar, actually. It's all to do with the amount of money being printed by the central banks. At the time, you didn't really know where this was coming from, but you could see the inflation rate. The price of houses were going up. The price of food was going up. Salaries going up. And, you know, when I started work, we're not talking about the sort of mediocre 5% pay rises you're getting these days. You know, inflation at one point in the UK was running at 30-odd%. So we were getting really hefty pay rises. And, you know, you could take your pay rise along to the bank and or along to the gold dealer and buy yourself a nice coin. And knowing almost with certainty that in a few years it was going to be worth a lot more.
Where do you see where we at now and where are we going?
Well, a little bit earlier, I talked about the printing of money that we saw in the 1970s, 80s, and obviously ongoing even today. And obviously that was driving the retail price index, the consumer price index, wages, the price of food and price of everything else. But, and I think a lot of people have become very fixated on the relationship between money supply and prices. But I've come to realize in recent years, it goes much, much deeper than that because we have on the planet a sort of money which wasn't really looked at as much in the past. And that's the huge level of government debt, which is massively exceeding the money supply. And don't forget, all of this government debt is a promise to print money down the line at some point in the future. But to all intents and purposes, it is money, because you and I can take my treasury bills, my treasury bonds, sell them instantly and turn it into cash. Not like the old days where you buy a bond from the post office, then you keep it to maturity 20 years later, and then you get your cash back. These days, the government debt is as good as money. It's no different from putting your money into a money market fund or a CD. It just happens to have a little bit longer maturity, but the day you want it back, you can get it back instantly. So what's going on in the world, and why do we have to look at government debt in addition to the money supply, which actually in some countries, the money supply isn't increasing that fast, but the government debt is. So what's going on here? When the government wants to spend more money than it's got, it borrows the difference. That's called a budget deficit. When it borrows money, the government gets poorer and someone else gets richer. So the government has been going deeper and deeper into debt forever, more or less. I mean, there were times in very, very distant past when they ran surpluses, but those days are gone. So the governments are going deeper and deeper into debt, and someone else, as they go deeper into debt, gets richer because they're spending that money. Now, that money which is being spent might be deployed by the wealth gatherers. These are the wealthy people. Could be somebody with a good job or somebody in retirement, or it could be an entrepreneur. But the wealth gatherers of this world, those who are not living hand to mouth, are accumulating the wealth. And what are they doing with it? Of course, they're buying treasury bills and they're putting money on CDs and so forth. But also, they are spending money on the kinds of things that wealthy people want to own, whether it be yachts, nice houses with a nice posh drive, paintings on the wall. I've got a few paintings behind me, which I paid a couple of $100 for. And suddenly, I'm not just talking about the extremely wealthy. I'm talking about anybody who gets to his retirement age and just has a comfortable life. He wants to be able to go on holiday. Well, holidays are in limited supply. So the prices of holidays will be rising, not by the increase in the amount of cash on the planet, but by the increase in the amount of wealth, which is better defined in particular by the amount of debt being created by the government, because that's what's being distributed. As you go into retirement, you might want a nice home. You might want to have pay your children's or your grandchildren's school fees. Those are going to cost more. You probably want to have some sort of medical care. You're going to see the doctor more often. That's going to cost more. And it's going to cost more, and the price will be rising, not in line with the consumer price index, but in line with the price of those things which are in limited supply. Because the consumer price index is an index of things, mostly things, which are made by robots. So when something's made by robots, the variable component, which is the human labor component, is not very high. So the prices of mass-produced goods only rise slowly, or in some cases, even go down. I mean, obviously, a television today costs a lot less than a television of 10 years ago.
Right.
Just to illustrate that, I have a nice 65-inch screen there, as you see. The one you see there, I bought it about 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I paid 6,000 Swiss francs for it. The one I'm staring at is exactly the same brand. It's a Samsung. It's the same size. It's UHD. It's identical. I paid $600. So something, you know, why? Because it's made by robots. So that's, you know, that's in the retail price index, the consumer price index, suppressing the growth of the index. But if I was to look at something which I want to spend my money on when I'm in retirement, medical care, perhaps I need a nurse to look after me and change my nappies or whatever you have to do when you're elderly, you know, that's going to cost a lot in terms of relative to today, a lot more than the consumer price index is increasing. So now we come to gold. So why is gold increasing? Well, it's simply that the level of debt is rising, and we talk about the United States, let's call it 7% a year. Gold has got a long way to go upwards if it's going to keep pace with the rise we've seen in the level of government debt. over the last few years, or even since 1971.
Okay, so you hit on a couple of things that, or one thing that I find very interesting. And there is this tug of war, if you would, about deflation versus inflation. If you would, people on the discussion, what are we going into? And I would really agree with you. And I think of what you're saying, because you're saying issuing of debt is basically, correct me if I'm wrong, is issuing of money. So issuing of debt is not deflationary. It's highly inflationary. Is that what you're saying?
It's inflationary in terms of the things which are in limited supply. Absolutely. Because you are giving money to the population. Now, it might go into the hands of the poor or the government workers or the army, some of whom will be living hand to mouth. But at the end of the day, these people are going to buy things from the entrepreneurs, and some of them will be sitting in nice plush office jobs. There'll be lawyers, bankers, accountants, architects, those sort of jobs. Or these days, I'd say plumbers and electricians. They're the ones who are making the money. But, you know, they will have skilled jobs, and they will be accumulating wealth, which they are saving, those who are doing it right, of course, will be saving for their retirement. And as they go into retirement, they're going to have the kind of things that they've been saving for. And they will have those things, provided they haven't invested it all in fiat currency. Because if they're investing in fiat currency in the bank, the prices of what they want to spend that money on will be rising faster than the interest that they are earning on the money. And that's before tax. After tax, it could be worse. It would be worse.
That's right. It's very interesting. Okay. So then my next question would be, again, is this demand for gold, is this just a market demand, would you say? It's hard to say who is buying it up, because we've had this rise with the, it seems like, the exponential issue of debt. Is this retail investors? You're in Switzerland. Is this coming from the Europeans? Is this coming from central banks? Or where do you see this buying of gold and precious metals coming from?
I retired 3 years ago. I spent my entire career working in wealth management in private banks. That's not the commercial banks that you see from day to day, where people put their deposits. Nobody deposits money in a private bank. A private bank is a bank which takes the money of the very, very wealthy and helps them manage it. And it does not make any commercial loans. It doesn't lend money out to all and sundry or to anybody. The only thing that private banks do in terms of lending is called Lombard lending. Lombard lending is where a client is able to borrow part of his own money, and that is money in the bank, not money which is somewhere else. So it's all very well. You might own yachts and houses. You can't borrow against that in a private bank. But if you have a portfolio of stocks worth 10 million, you can borrow 7 million or whatever you want. It depends on the bank and how much lending value they give to each stock. And that's worked out daily. And some clients will borrow money against that. So my career was in wealth management. And one of the assets we had in Switzerland, always had, was gold. Now, when I arrived in Switzerland back in the 80s, it was traditional to have 5% of your portfolio in gold. But over the years, over the decades, that kind of went away. Banks, and private banks in particular, kind of wanted their clients to invest in things which were more economic in value. So stocks and shares. And of course, you had this concept of the 60-40 principle, where you had 60% in bonds and 40% in shares, or vice versa, depending on the person's age and other aspects. And gold kind of withered away to a 0% allocation officially. Now, in the bank where I worked, we had, as relationship managers, some flexibility to have a variance on the recommended allocation for a particular client of up to 5% in anything. So any client who would listen to me would have his 5% in gold instead of the recommended zero. Now, since I've retired, I do know that a number of banks have started to put gold back into the portfolios of clients. You know, it depends on the bank, but I think typically it's varying between 2 and 5%. I think that figure will rise if we have any sort of pause in the stock market, which maybe we're seeing right now. It's not sure, but you know, there's been a little bit of a wobble recently in the recent weeks since Christmas. So it could be that they start to increase their exposure to gold from 2 to 5 to maybe the range of 5 to 10. I personally think that would be a very good move. I personally recommend that, I won't use the word recommend because we don't make recommendations here, but I think for a multimillionaire who's typical of the clients I used to look after, an exposure of 12% is a good number.
That's great.
To precious metals in general.
That is great. Go ahead.
And that's a mathematically calculated figure by me, which is designed to give you good upside without too much risk to the downside and smooth out the ups and downs of your other investments. Of course, we don't know the future of the gold price, but I personally think that it will go higher for a number of reasons.
Yeah, let's talk about that. If I can ask you a couple of questions or maybe a couple of points. I chuckled when you said 5%, because I'm there, totally there. But you just don't hear that, especially here in the States. And it's interesting, maybe because you're in Switzerland and your clients were in Switzerland, that would make a lot more sense, at least anecdotally, just because of the background of the Swiss. But it makes me think too, if we ever, because money managers and wealth advisors, portfolio managers nowadays, I don't want to say they never say that, but I'll say that they never say that, or they never give that recommendation of that kind of allocation. I guess my question is, you think we're going back to that kind of, if you would, allocation in the wealth preservation and wealth management world? Do you think so, or?
I think there's a chance. I'm not going to say it's a dead cert. It's more likely than not. But perhaps I just make a comment as to why there seems to be this reluctance all over the world to put gold in a portfolio. Yeah. When you put gold in a client's portfolio, the bank earns almost nothing. You must remember that if you buy a fund for a client, the bank is starting to receive ongoing commissions year after year, the rebates from the fund manager. And the banks, certainly here in Europe, by law, have to tell the clients about those rebates. So it's not that the clients don't know, but clients are befuddled by the small print and the huge wads of paper and information, which is now delivered electronically, which nobody ever reads anyway. So it's not like it'll be one client in 1,000 who says, you're getting all these fees, can I have a bit of it back, please? And that's the sort of client who's already negotiated his fees so low that he's not really attractive to the client anyway, to the bank anyway. And by the way, I'd like to stress that I have never, ever been paid in any way, shape or form according to the revenues that the bank makes or the revenues that my clients were making for the bank. You get a salary, and that was the kind of bank I worked for. I know there are banks out there, and I won't name them, where what you earn is related to what the bank earns off your client base, but I was never ever worked in one of those banks. So it was all about doing the right thing, and we had quite very high moral standards. But at the end of the day, when you own investments, if you own a portfolio of shares, what's going to happen? They'll be traded. They'll be bought, sold, bought, sold. That's commission on every trade. If you own a fund, you might keep the fund for a long time, but there will still be this flow of money from the fund manager. So if you buy a fund run by any of the major investment management firms, they have a rebate system back to the the bank. Of course, these days, lots of banks are, for moral reasons, are starting to say we don't want those rebates, but I'm quite sure globally it's going on a lot. So the bank is making a retrocession or a fee, a kickback from the fund manager year after year after year. And you wouldn't be getting that with gold. If you own a bar of gold, it's never going to pay you anything. The only way you'll ever make money when you sell gold, and in Switzerland, most places don't charge any commission on purchases and sales of gold, is perhaps a small 0.5% spread between the bid and ask price. And that's not really even as much as you get on buying a share. I think there's still this reluctance globally to have too much gold in a portfolio where the investment advisor is not really making enough to feed himself. But do I think it's coming back? Yes, I think it is. The pressure's on because we're starting to see an increased level of central bank buying. You may recollect that, I think it was the 80s, under the guidance or instructions of the IMF, many, many central banks, not the United States, but many, many central banks were effectively ordered and agreed to start selling off their gold. So every year we'd have these gold auctions as the central banks got together and auctioned off their gold, and they had less and less of it. And then there came a point where the bank started to say, the central bank started to say, we're not going to do it anymore. We think we've sold enough. And that's when the price took off. We've gone from a sort of stable situation going back a few years now to a situation where some central banks, Poland, China, for example, are back in the market and acquiring gold. And why are they doing that? It's because the level of their foreign exchange reserves has risen a lot over the decades, but their exposure to gold, at least in terms of ounces, has been fairly static. But now the level of foreign exchange reserves which is mostly dollars and dollar treasury bills, means that their gold reserves are perhaps no more than 2 or 3% of their total reserves. So central banks have started to buy, those who don't have much, are starting to buy gold to improve their exposure to gold and reduce their exposure to the dollar. Now, the one I look at most, although they're not the biggest buyer, Poland was the biggest buyer, but the one I look at most is China. China did have an increase in its reserves over the last 12 months, and they were buyers of gold at the start of the year and at the end of the year, November, December. Their gold reserves increased, sorry, not their gold reserves, their total reserves increased, but 80% of that increase was accounted for by gold. Two things. One, the buying of gold that they did, and two, by the increase in the price of gold. So notwithstanding that by October, we were looking at an all-time record in the price of gold, in November, when the price had dipped $100 or $200, it went down from a record of $2,700-something an ounce to $2,600-something an ounce. China, who'd taken their foot off the accelerator for a few months, put it back on the accelerator after that $100, $200 drop and started buying again in November, and they bought again in December. The amount of gold they bought in December was twice as much as they bought in November. The amount of gold they bought in December was twice the amount they bought in November.
I had no idea.
Yep. So I haven't got the figures in my head, but it was more than double in December than November. So despite the fact we are a tiny fraction of a percent off the all-time high, they see fit to go back into the market. And the consequence of that is that a large percentage of the almost all of the increase in their reserves is accounted for by gold. So what does that mean? It means they value gold more than any other asset they could hold.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not the only central bank doing this, but other banks around the world are probably now looking at the Chinese action and saying, well, if they're buying it, perhaps we should think about it too. And if they're going to buy more, which is quite obvious, they seem to be in that direction, maybe we should be ahead of the curve and buy before them.
Yeah.
Now, it's having worked in a bank, I can tell you decisions aren't quick and easy to make. It's not like some guy listens to your channel and says, oh, they said buy gold. I better go and buy it for the central bank. He's going to have loads of meetings. He's going to go through the legal department of the central bank, the compliance department, the risk department, the economics department, the head of the bank, and multiple other people who've got to have their say. It's going to take months, if not years, to gradually shift that point of view in a direction from what they've been doing all along. But I think the buying by central banks is set to now start to increase. Central banks are completely insensitive to what the price of the gold is when they buy it, because after all, for the most part, they can print money at any time at ease if they want to and buy gold. They're not going to do that necessarily because that would devalue the currency and be a bit too visible. But we've seen that happening. We see it happening because countries around the world are issuing debt. And what are they doing with the debt? Well, some of it can be used to buy gold. And I think that's what's going to happen. The other reason they're buying gold, I think, is a general level of worry about the treasuries, because most of them hold U.S. treasuries. Of course, they hold bonds issued by the European Central Bank and European governments and the UK as well, but it's mostly US paper.
Yeah.
We have a situation, and we've had it for many years, where nothing is being done to address the rising budget deficits. So the level of debt is rising now faster than at any time in all of history, with the one exception of the COVID year or year two, when it did rise very, very rapidly. But we're certainly way beyond pre-COVID levels, big time. And if you look at the USA, we've got the figures from the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, which shows that according to their own numbers, the level of debt is set to rise at a faster pace than the economy. In other words, that's called the debt to GDP ratio. So the debt to GDP, gross domestic product, the debt is going to rise faster than the gross domestic product. So put that in perspective. If you were an individual in the same situation, it would mean that your credit card debt is increasing, let's say, by 20% a year, but your salary is only going up by 3% a year. Now, the figures aren't quite as extreme as that, but you can see the picture that we have a country whose level of debt is rising faster than their economy is growing. So eventually, in a very extreme situation, you arrive at a situation where the debt is infinity. But we're not talking about that yet. But we will get to a situation based on the CBO's numbers and projecting it forward, where the interest payments on the debt, potentially by the time your children, certainly your grandchildren, become adults, will be exceeding the total tax take of the country and possibly exceeding the GDP. Now, that's an impossible situation. Because before we get that, you have a hyperinflationary collapse. So we're not going to get there. And there are solutions to solve this before we get there. But central banks around the world are saying, we don't see any action to put in place these solutions. So Where are we going? No action. They're not reining in the spending. They're not increasing the taxes. And there's other things which could be done, but none of those things are being done. And therefore, we don't know where this is going. Therefore, we're not sure that when we eventually get paid in 10 years, 5 years, 20 years, 30 years, whatever your maturity is, we're not sure that we're going to get paid in something which is actually useful to us.
Yeah. So, man, you just said a lot. Really good. That leads, I guess, you were going there about 10 minutes ago. What does this really mean for then the price of gold moving forward that you see? And it's somewhat of a rhetorical question, but I want you to answer it. Because you have exponential spending and debt, if you would, and we're going back to a thesis, which I would agree with, and it's fascinating, by the way, of more or less debt is pretty money. So yes, if you could answer that, where are we at right now with the price of gold? And again, this is somewhat a lot of conjecture and speculation. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I'll come back with the price in a minute. Many of your viewers will know the story, which is called The Emperor with No Clothes. It's a story about an emperor who was tricked by some tricksters into believing that he was buying clothes which were invisible to everybody except anybody who was an idiot. So when he dressed himself in these invisible clothes, he didn't want to admit that he couldn't see them because it would show he's an idiot. And so, and the same thing for all his courtiers and the people around him, nobody would admit they couldn't see these invisible clothes, which weren't clothes at all. So he then had a big parade in the street to show off his clothes, walking around completely naked, and all the crowd, not daring to say the emperor's got no clothes, all said, oh, they're so beautiful, until a little boy shouts out, "Mummy, the emperor's got no clothes on." And then all hell breaks loose. So in terms of the US debt and the debt of other countries, we are at levels which were in the past seen as impossible and unprecedented and extremely bad for the world. In many places, United States included, UK included, Europe, Japan, the debt levels are exceeding 100% of GDP. Nobody really knows where the correct level should be. Some people say a country could have 40% debt to GDP. When the Maastricht Treaty was signed, you couldn't become a member of the EU unless you had a debt-to-GDP ratio of less than 60%, because that's where they thought the worst-case scenario lay, and where, you know, in many places, well over 100 now. So we don't know when that little boy is going to shout, "Emperor's got no clothes," or this debt, the level of debt, is unsustainable. You know, it can never be repaid. It can never be reduced. And one of the problems we've got is the debt which we now have, which has been massively increased in two phases in the global financial crisis and secondly in the COVID crisis. When that debt was increased in those crises, it was increased at very low interest rates. Don't forget we had what's called ZIRP, Z-I-R-P, zero interest rate policy. So interest rates for more than a decade were as good as zero. In Europe, they were negative. In United States, UK, they were as good as zero. I think it was 0.25% or something like that in the United States. So the government was able to, despite the rapidly expanding levels of debt, the government was able to issue more debt, yet pay less interest because the interest rates had gone to zero. The trouble is, all that debt is coming to maturity. Every time they borrowed money over the last decade, it would have had a maturity date, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and so forth. Most of it will mature in the next decade. As it matures, it has to be renewed, but the interest rate on that debt won't be 1 or 2% anymore. It'll be a higher rate. And it's a higher rate on a much larger level of debt than ever before. And to add to that, we've got the annual surpluses, which have now become, it's a certainty we're going to have surpluses and very large surpluses. So all of that has to be borrowed at what will be and what is much higher interest rates than over the last 10 or 15 years. So what does that mean? It means that the interest payments by the government on the level of debt is increasing rapidly, and it's soaking up a greater and greater percentage of what the government gets in taxes, meaning that the government has to borrow more and more because the interest rate is spiraling out of control. So we'll come back to the gold price. There's been calls to bring some discipline to the world by perhaps going back on a gold standard. I don't think that's possible because people wouldn't trust it given what's happened in the past. Of course, if they went on a gold standard, there'd be a large number of people who will say, given what's already happened, I'll have my gold, please. You know, Gresham's law all over again. You know, that's why they effectively banned Americans from owning gold in 1933, because people were saying, I'd have my gold, please. And that's why they, from 1968, stopped delivering gold to foreign governments and made it official in 1971, because people were saying, there's too many dollars out there, I'll have my gold, please. So what if we went back on the gold standard? Well, I'm quite sure a lot of people would say, well, if we're on a gold standard, there's absolutely no risk whatsoever for me holding gold. So why would I own paper? Because I can always redeem my gold for the paper at a fixed price. So I'll take the gold in case they do what they did a year after 1933 and 1934, when they changed the price of gold from $20.67 to $35, or halving the value of the dollar on the foreign exchange markets in one night. So people would take the gold. So the gold price would have to be a lot higher if we were to go on a gold price. Now, if we were on a gold standard in the United States, for example, who has the most gold in the entire world, if the national debt was to be backed one for one against gold, I'm talking about the principal of the debt, not the interest as well, if it was backed one for one against the gold they actually own, we'd need a price of $1.35 million per ounce. Now, that's never going to happen. and of course, no central bank or no government would say we need a one-for-one backing against our debt. But that's what they did have a long, long, long time ago. But they would say, in the modern world, they'd say, okay, we don't need more than 5% or 10% or 20%. But if they only got 20% backing, everyone's going to rush along to the bank and say, I'll have my gold, please. So what price should gold be? I mean, I think if I'm more realistic here, and we take the increase in the level of government debt since we came off the gold standard in 1971, and we mustn't forget the reason we came off the gold standard was because the level of debt was already way too high compared with the gold in stock. But if we just take that number, that very high number, and look at where it is today, we should be at a gold price of about 5,500, well, going on 6,000 now. So do I think we're going to go there? I think we're going to go there. I think we'll go beyond. I think we'll do that gradually as people come to realize that it's a way of protecting the liquid part of their portfolio, the liquid part of it, and the part where you kind of savings part, as opposed to the more volatile part, which is the equity side. I think people will start to little by little increase their gold exposure, provided they're allowed to by their governments. But we are today in every country in the world, more or less, not every country, but most of them. So yes, I think we're on our way to a much higher price. I think it will take time, because we mustn't forget that every ounce of gold which is out there and in private hands has a price at which they will sell it. So any attempt to go higher at every all-time high, we will see sellers appear, just as we always have done. But then in my lifetime, I don't know how many all-time highs I've seen, but there's been probably hundreds and hundreds of them. I don't think I've ever seen an all-time low.
Yeah, great point. Let's end on this. I'm very curious, because of your perspective, because you live in Europe, if you could just briefly talk about what's the difference between wealthy investors that you deal with in Europe and their perspective on gold. And you already somewhat mentioned this and went there, but talk a little bit about that, as opposed to what you know, or if you know what's going on here in the US, because my perspective here with the US investors, nobody cares and nobody's interested, or very little, I should say. Is it different? It seems to be a lot different in Zurich and in Switzerland.
I think I'd use a little bit different. The reality is, everybody thinks that things will carry on the same as they are until they don't. So if you can go to the petrol station and get petrol, you call it gas in America. If you can go to the gas station and get gas, you assume you'll always be able to go to the gas station and get gas. You could go to the supermarket and get food, and you assume there'll always be food in the supermarket. And then one day, something happens, and it's different. And you say, wow, that's weird. You know, what I thought was normality, and I always thought water would come out of the tap, or electricity, we'd have electricity in our home, or the internet, or food on the table. You know, and suddenly something happens and it's all different. You know, COVID was perhaps one of those examples where we went through a very weird situation where the shops, many of the shops were closed, and you know, a lot of people were put into all kinds of different types of problems, and people who always could go to work suddenly found, hairdressers, for example, suddenly found they weren't allowed to work. You know, the normality changed. So people in America and Europe think that there is no need to stack gold or silver or certain other things, because they would be taking out insurance for something they don't think is ever going to happen. Just like, it's kind of weird because they insure the house against fire and flood, but they don't insure their wealth against money, or their savings in the bank against monetary collapse, right, which is, unless something's done about it, it will be the end result. Now, I just want to stress, I'm not trying to forecast Armageddon for the financial system, because something will be done about it, but what will be done about it probably is going to be different from what many people expect, and it's going to happen when they're not expecting it, and because it will happen when it's not expecting it, many people will be holding the wrong asset, i.e. bonds or cash, on the wrong day, and they will, even if there's warning signs, they won't be able to react, because there'll be a queue of people in front of them who figured it out before they did, and you won't be able to get through to your bank, your financial institution, and do what you think you have to do to protect yourself.
Right. Yes. Interesting. Well, Clive, I kept you way too long. We have gone for almost an hour here. If they want to know more about your work, they want to read about you or listen to you, how do they do that?
So, the only social media that I'm involved with is on LinkedIn. I write 2 or 3 articles per week, or posts, they call them, on LinkedIn. Things about the central bank, things about the economy, things about the gold or silver or stock market. So it could be. I've written about Bitcoin too, by the way. There's no asset I don't write about. I've written about the labor market, housing. So people can read about that on LinkedIn. I'm more than happy to answer sensible financial questions. Along the lines of, I've been to see my financial advisor and this is what he's recommending. What do you think, Clive? But the people who would like to have a conversation with me along the lines of, I've got a half a trillion tons of gold in Ghana to sell you. Don't bother, please.
Yeah. Well, and I'll tell the listeners and viewers that are still with us, Clive has been exceptionally gracious to me, and it was very responsive on LinkedIn. So I'm sure he'll be the same to you. On that note, it's kind of funny, and it's not funny. I don't recommend people doing this arbitrarily. And what I'm about to say is, my mother, I told her in 2007, right when we were going through the financial storm there during that, I told my mom, I don't know what's going to happen. And my mom is independently wealthy. I go, Mom, you need to put it all in gold. Put it in gold and have cash. That's it. And her financial advisor told her no. And I'm not, again, this is not a recommendation. I go, Mom, fire him. Go get another financial advisor and do it. Just do what I just said. And she did everything that she fired her financial advisor. She got a new one and she put her money in gold and just had cash. And now she has a bunch of stocks, huge portfolio, blah, 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 blah. But
very important to be diversified and not yes. have all the eggs in one basket. And there's zero reason to have more than you need in nice, safe cash and bonds, because one day they won't be nice and safe.
Yes. Yeah. And I would agree. But my point is like, your financial advisor works for you, get recommendations, but they work for you. So Clive, I want to thank you so much. I'll put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes here. I'm a big fan of yours, and I'm very, very grateful for our time.
Thank you very much, Andy. And I hope that all your viewers give you a nice thumbs up.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too.